organizers for inviting me. I'm still tickled by that. We've heard a lot already in the first day and a half about zeros of L functions and extreme values. I'm going to talk about what happens when zeros go astray, or if you like, very extreme values, those are poles. I've given this talk a number of times now, so some of you may have heard it, but I'm going to try to give it a different emphasis from what I have before that I think is appropriate to the workshop. This is only a half an hour talk, so this will be the short version, in fact, with the result that I'll be rather imprecise at certain times, starting now with the first slide, which is on the converse theorem. Here I'm speaking of the converse theorem, Weyl's converse theorem for modular forms, but this slide is so vague that it would actually apply to any of its more general cousins with only a few changes. If you're new to the converse theorem, it's so called because it gives a converse to the analytic continuation and functional equation of the L function of a modular form. So it deduces modularity from analytic data. A little more precisely, suppose I have some Dirichlet series, which I'll call LSF, with some coefficients satisfying an a priori bound, like this. Then I define a twisted Dirichlet series, LSF cross chi, just by multiplying the coefficients by chi of n. Now, given the bound on the coefficients, these define analytic functions, these series converge and define analytic functions in some right half plane. But now we assume, we impose some hypotheses on these functions. Suppose for each twisted L function, now each, really I should say each in an appropriate family, that will depend on the data, the level in particular. Suppose each one of them continues to an entire function, first of all. That continuation is of finite order and satisfies a precise functional equation. Precise here means not any old functional equation, but a certain one that you can write down, okay, with exact epsilon factors. Then the conclusion is that this Dirichlet series is in fact an L function, the L function of a modular form. Now, if you'll permit me to wax philosophical for 30 seconds, one can think of these twisted L functions as independent objects, and that somehow modularity encapsulates these nice analytic properties, 1, 2, and 3, of all of the twists together. Okay, now that's a good philosophy when things work the way they're supposed to. Okay, like for example, if you think of zeros, one doesn't expect much interaction or much dependence between the zeros of one L function and another. But what I want to talk about, part of what I want to talk about, is that if you introduce pathologies into this otherwise nice picture, then at that point there is some interdependence between these different twists, and you can get new information out of that. Okay. So that leads me next to what I'll call the converse theorem with poles. Which is basically the same thing. So let LSF and the twisted version be as on this slide. Now suppose three conditions that are meant to replace these three in Weyl. Okay. First of all, point one, that this function continues to a meromorphic function. Okay. This is where the main gain comes from. We don't assume entire anymore. We assume meromorphic, but with some controls over the poles, so they're strictly inside the critical strip, and for that, for me, that means between 0 and 1. Okay. Second, well, the condition that replaces 2 over here is that that continued meromorphic function is a ratio of entire functions of finite order. Okay. And 3 satisfies a functional equation, but now viewed in the land of meromorphic functions rather than holomorphic ones. Note that actually points 2 and 3 for a holomorphic function are equivalent to 2 and 3 over here, okay, by the Friedmann-Lindelof principle. All right, so this is where the main gain comes from, is point 1. But we impose one more condition, this the strictest one, okay, condition 4, that LSF itself has at most finitely many poles. Okay. Then the conclusion is the same. That it's the L function of a modular form. Now you might at this point say, well, what's the big deal? Finitely many poles is not far removed from entire. So is there any real gain here? Well, the point is that this fourth condition, the strict condition, is needed only for one L function, okay, where we need now the weaker ones for all of the twists. Okay, so that will allow, in certain circumstances, to reduce the number of twists required to one. Okay. Now, I think I'm going to go in a little bit different order from what I had planned to talk about art and L functions sooner, basically because this theorem, as it's stated, for GL2 has only one interesting application that I can think of, and that is to art and L functions. Okay, let me just remind you of what those are. Suppose we have an irreducible complex Galois representation, rho. Then Artin attaches to this data an L function defined like that. If that makes sense to you, great. If not, it doesn't matter. You can just think of this as attaching analytic data to this algebraic object. Okay. But I can motivate it a little better than that. If you take, for example, K to be a cyclotomic extension of the rationals, then this representation is one-dimensional. It's nothing more than a Dirichlet character, and you recover Dirichlet's L functions. Okay, so in general, Artin conjectured that these non-abelian generalizations of Dirichlet L functions continue to entire functions and satisfy functional equations. Okay. Now, Artin himself proved the one-dimensional case of his conjecture over a number field through the development of class field theory. And since then, we've had some progress, notably in the case of two-dimensional representations. But still there are some two-dimensional cases where the conjecture is not yet known. Most progress on the conjecture to date is linked to progress of the Langlands program, okay, which anticipates that these Artin L functions are in fact the L functions of automorphic representations or modular forms in this two-dimensional case. What do we know in general? Well, we know the theorem of Brouwer that says that this Artin L function can be written as a product of different L functions, of L functions of Hecke characters over fields between Q and K. I emphasize here, this is not a factorization of the L function. Okay, the Artin L function is already a primitive object, and these Hecke L functions are more complicated things. Okay, so unless the product is trivial, in which case there's just one member, okay, then actually some of these EIs have to be negative. Right, so the point here is that this expression has a denominator, okay, with which will have zeros. Well, then the Artin's conjecture is that every time there's a zero in the denominator of this expression, there's one in the numerator to cancel it. Okay, but we don't know that for sure. However, you do get a lot of information out of Brouwer's theorem, in particular the analytic continuation and functional equation of the Artin L function. In the two-dimensional case, this was known to be the correct functional equation of what you'd expect from the converse theorem by a result of Langlands. So basically, from Brouwer's theorem, you get these points 1, 2, and 3. Okay, in this theorem right here. So, well, if we have an Artin L function that's not modular, then the only thing that can go wrong is number 4, point 4, and that leads to this corollary. Okay, so if we have a two-dimensional Galois representation, if it's not modular, in fact, the L function has infinitely many poles. So in particular, Artin's conjecture that the L function is entire implies modularity. Okay, I'll just add that, so pretty much everything I say today you can do over a number field, too, although the answer is a little different. I haven't gotten around to writing that up yet, so I don't want to talk about it yet.
It should be emphasized that you're not twisting. It's not one guy in that case.
Right. In the number field case, so what you need in the number field case are twists by fully unramified characters, and there are infinitely many over a number field, infinitely many in general. All right. Well, let's see the first steps in proving this theorem. I'll run through a sketch of the proof of this. Let's take an example, a concrete example. If we're talking about the L function of a holomorphic modular form of weight 1 and level n and trivial character, so for gamma not n, then it satisfies a functional equation like this. If I define lambda of s to be L of s with a gamma factor attached, then it has this functional equation. All right, now the first step in the proof of the regular converse theorem is, it's a Mellin inversion step that undoes what you do to prove the functional equation for the L function. So we write f of z to be this Fourier series with these coefficients a n. This is my form that is supposed to be a modular form. Let's see what happens if I look at f of iy. So I look at this on the imaginary axis. Okay, that's this expression here, sum of a n e to the minus 2 pi n y. Now, there are two Mellin transforms that you need to know in this subject. Okay, this is one of them. E to the minus 2 pi n y is this integral right here against gamma of s. And now sigma came from this bound I had on the coefficient. So I've taken the contour to be a vertical line far to the right, far enough to the right that I can change the order of sum and integral here. And so this is what you end up with. You end up with, a n n to the minus s, sum over n is that L function, okay, times the gamma factor, 2 pi to the minus s gamma of s, y to the minus s, so that's this integral here. All right, now I use the new information I have that this function continues and satisfies a functional equation, so I plug in the functional equation in the next line. Change variables, change s to 1 minus s, and you get this last line here. Now there's one unwritten step, and that's to go from here to there, I shift the contour. Okay, I shift from minus sigma minus 1 to back to sigma plus 2 again. Here I'm using, I'm assuming that the L function is entire. Okay, so I didn't say that, but there it's written. And there's where I need the control in the middle of the critical strip, the finite order. So I can apply Fragman-Lindelof and justify the shift of contour. So if you shift the contour, then basically unraveling the steps that I did to get here, okay, you get f at a different point. So that's the point. This is how the first step in the proof of the converse theorem goes. It establishes a link between functional equations and of L functions and symmetries of the function f. Okay. Oh, I should say. So both sides here are analytic, f of iy and this. So I get this for all z where it makes sense in the upper half. Okay. To continue with the proof of the converse theorem, you would then take these other twisted L functions and do the same procedure. This would give you more symmetries of the function f. And eventually you get enough of these twists to generate the full congruence group that you're working over. I'm going to do something different. I'm going to stick with this equation, which is an equation. Which is an equation, a Fourier series about the cusp at infinity. But I want to look at what happens if we look into a different cusp, a cusp alpha, say a rational number, on the real line. Okay, so I'll just plug in z equals alpha times 1 plus iy, where I'm thinking of y as a small positive number. All right, so f of z is this expression. All right. Now, a crucial point here is that because of the additivity of the exponential, I can write this as a n e of n alpha times another exponential. Okay, it's exactly that. And now I can do the same Mellin transform trick, but I get an integral this time, not against lambda sf, but against a twisted version. Okay. Basically the same thing, but with coefficients twisted now by an additive character, e of n alpha. And I call that lambda sf alpha. Okay, so keep that in your memory for now. Let's look now on the other side. So here is what I had there. I plugged that in. Try to do the same thing, but now it doesn't work because we have a 1 plus iy in the denominator now, not the numerator. And although many of my calculus students seem to try to pull that out, it doesn't work. Okay. But remember, I said y is a small number, so we can approximate 1 over 1 plus iy by 1 minus iy. Okay? If that approximation were exactly right, then I'd get just this without the exponential factor there. Okay, this quadratic correction term is what you get from the other, from writing 1 over 1 plus iy exactly. All right. So this is what I have. This is certainly true. We have always this 1 plus iy in the denominator here. Now the trick is to expand this in a Taylor series around y equals 0. So for y small, this big ugly expression, this correction factor, looks like this. Here's the first couple terms in the Taylor series. Now here this is a convergent Taylor series, the dot 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 makes sense. Elsewhere I put dots in where you'll have something that doesn't converge. What I mean there is that, well, you can take as many terms as you want, plus some error, plus some remainder term in each case. Alright, well, let's say we just do the sum by replacing this correction factor by 1. Okay. Well, then we can do it just like we did before. You get, again, an integral against an additive twisted L function. Okay. This one, this time a twist by minus 1 over n alpha. Okay. I call that lambda s f minus 1 over n alpha. Now, I say that this first order term, the next term in the Taylor series, corresponds to this particular differential operator. What do I mean by that? Well, you see, in here I've got a minus 2 pi n y over n alpha. If I want, in this expression here, if I want to bring down a factor of minus 2 pi y, or minus 2 pi n over n alpha, all I have to do is differentiate with respect to y. See? So in fact, if I've got, well, this expression exactly corresponds to this differential operator. Okay? Well, now, of course, I want to do that to the right-hand side, to the integral. All right. What I get is that, the right-hand side of what I had is this. And now, well, you can calculate, just differentiate under the integral sign. That will bring down a factor of s, I guess. And so there's a hidden contour shift in here. When you differentiate, that's the same thing as shifting the contour here by 1, so we end up with lambda of s plus 1. Okay? Plus dot, dot, dot. Well, let's bring the two sides together now. So this is what I had before, and here are the first two terms of what you get on the right-hand side. Now we apply Mellin inversion, so this becomes an identity between the L functions. Okay, plus these dots turn into an error term, which I claim is holomorphic for the real part of s greater than minus 1. Now this is, I'm skipping a lot of steps here. Basically, so for the next several terms, you'll continue this analysis, and you'll get higher terms, lambda of s plus 2, lambda of s plus 3, etc. At some point, you stop doing that, and you use the other information you have on the coefficients, which comes from this trivial bound. Okay, that and standard estimates on Taylor, on the remainder in Taylor's theorem, okay, will tell you what I've said here, that this that at least that part of the remainder is holomorphic for the real part of s greater than minus 1. And now we've assumed by hypothesis that each of these functions continues down at least to the 1 line. All right. That means that everything from lambda of s plus 2 and beyond is actually holomorphic to the right of minus 1. Okay, so that's what we get. I'm glossing over another point here. That's that I've got additive twists, and the converse theorem is stated with multiplicative twists, so there's a transition you have to do between those, but that can be done. All right, now I claim something curious here, that this equation shows that if, in fact, these additive twists are holomorphic outside of the critical strip, then, in fact, they're entire. Okay. How does that go? Well, let's suppose we had some pole of this left-hand side strictly inside the critical strip between 0 and 1. All right. Well, that means there's a pole on the right-hand side. But now these second two terms are holomorphic at least to the right of 0. Okay. Because here I've got s plus 1 and h of s is holomorphic to the right of minus 1. That means the only guy on the right-hand side that can have a pole is the first one. All right, well, no problem, you say. That one has a pole. But now this second term is, well, it's patently obvious that it's related to the first one. Okay, so unless that pole happens to be at 1, I guess, okay, which we ruled out, I've said it's strictly inside the critical strip, then this second term also has a pole. Okay, but not at S, but at 1 less. Okay, so if I had a pole in the critical strip between 0 and 1, now this L function has a pole between minus 1 and 0. Okay, but you notice none of the other terms can do that. None of the other terms can have a pole there. So we get a contradiction, and that shows that, as soon as they're... Well, there can't be a pole, okay? So they have to be entire. That basically completes the proof of this theorem, except for a few details. I assumed right from the beginning that LSF was entire, and I stated that you can do it with finitely many poles. Okay, so let's see how that goes. So if LSF has poles, remember, well, this will only matter at the point when we shift the contour. Remember, at some point in the derivation of that original equation, I shifted the contour. If there are no poles, that's fine. Okay. More generally, if there are poles, you pick up a residue sum. Okay. Sum of residues between them. There it is. Again, let's say there are finitely many poles. So this is actually an analytic expression in Y, so I can write the same thing for Z. You have to take to make appropriate sense of z to the minus s here. I want a branch in the upper half plane, which is a little strange, but that's what it is. And now remember, the main idea of this proof was to take to look at this in the cusp. So we'll plug in z equals alpha times 1 plus iy again, and I get this expression out. Now certainly if there are only finitely many poles, then this is a perfectly well-defined function, even around y equals 0. This is analytic in a neighborhood of y equals 0. And the main point here was to take the Mellin transform of this. Okay, the Mellin transform of anything with a Taylor development around 0 will have only poles at integers. There are no integers strictly inside the critical strip. Okay, so this doesn't change the end argument here at all. But I should also point out that assuming finitely many poles is actually much stronger than what we need. You really only need to make sense of this expression here near y equals 0. Okay? And as long as this expression is not so bad so as to have a fractional pole in its Mellin transform, then the conclusion follows. So I'll point out a few other things here. Notice that this exponential factor, e to the I pi over 2s, cancels the decay of the gamma factor on one side. It augments it on the other. So basically, you're looking at the residue sum for poles of height up to about 1 over y. Okay. So if, for example, I knew that this residue sum converged sufficiently quickly on its own, as I would get, for example, if every time there was a pole of this L function, I knew that there was a zero very close by, in an appropriate sense, counting multiplicity. So very close by here might mean, say, within distance 1 over t cubed, if I had a pole at height t. Then this would certainly make sense around y equals 0, and I'd get the same conclusion. So there are many ways to state it. If you know that your Artinel function is close to holomorphic in this sense, then you get the result. Well, someone told me this is supposed to be a conference about random matrix theory. And until 3 seconds ago, I hadn't said either the word random or matrix. But I thought I could at least say what these ideas might have to say about this problem. So I'll just recall Montgomery's paracorrelation results and conjecture. So we've already seen a much better exposition of this by Montgomery himself. I certainly hope I've gotten the formula right, given the audience. I'm going to state this a little differently than the way one normally does. Often one writes the sums with all zeros, counting multiplicity, but I want to write it over distinct zeros with multiplicities in there, which I call E, M, E, N. All right, then here's the formula. And it's true as long as the support of the Fourier transform of your test function f is contained within minus 1 to 1. But Montgomery conjectures that it should remain true without that condition. If that conjecture is true, then, well, that has various consequences. So, for example, you can take your f to be basically a delta function around 0. Then what you end up with is that the average of the square multiplicity, so the sum of these em squared, in an average is 1. On average is 1. That implies one fact that Montgomery mentioned yesterday, that 100% of the zeros of zeta are simple, okay, if the conjecture is true. The reason I wrote multiplicities in there is you can do the same thing even for functions with poles. Okay. So I say the main ingredients in the proof, that's not quite right. The main things that you need in order to derive the known partial results, that's the right way to say it, for Montgomery's conjecture, were shown by Rudnick and Sarnak to be basically these. You need an explicit formula. An approximate Ramanujan conjecture, that comes in because they were working on GLN. Here, that's not a problem. Okay, certainly not for zeta, but not for Artinel functions either. Okay. And three, nice behavior of the Rankine-Solberg L function at 1 and to the right. So I'd like to point out that all of these are true for Artinel functions. I haven't, I'll confess right away, I haven't gone through all of the details to check this, but I don't see any obstacles. And the point here is that, well, then once you have these partial results, unlike in the case of zeta, where you get this two-thirds result from, even with restricted support, I don't see how you could get a partial result in that direction here, because you don't have positivity anymore. But nevertheless, you can make an analogous conjecture, analogous to Montgomery's conjecture. And if you had that conjecture, well, you get the same thing. If the average of the EN squareds is 1, okay, that means that almost all of them are 1. In particular, that there are almost no poles. Okay, so more precisely, you get little o of T log T poles up to height T. Now, this is already a very strong conjecture, and even this is still a far cry from what you would need to prove Artin's conjecture by these means, so I don't think we can seriously pretend that this is any kind of attack on the Artin conjecture, but I think it's interesting nonetheless. So let's go to lunch.
What bound would actually, what can you capture? How many poles?
I mean, with
X state by your method, you can't have finite many. You can have infinitely many poles as long as it doesn't grow too fast. What's the best?
As long as this residue sum converges.
You can't formulate it.
No,
in terms of
I don't think so. No.
Back at 2:30 after lunch.